You're listening to a Share Radio podcast. Share Sunday, bringing you a different side of business.
And it's Share Sunday with Nick Peters. For the next hour, we'll be on the shop floor. Today, the TUC on self-employment and exploitation. Microbiz champion Tony Robinson talks about the TUC and about the IOD's call for fairer taxation that we heard about just before the news. Why so many companies are failing to manage their talent properly. And former Lib Dem business minister Jo Swinson with her thoughts on what automation might mean for carers and about her post-political career promoting gender equality. First, though, the TUC this week leapt to the defence of self-employed people, who, they said, are earning significantly less these days in real and nominal terms than they used to, many of them sucked into the twilight world of a type of self-employment that's actually, by any standards, employment but without rights. There is also, however, evidence that, by and large, the self-employed like their flexible lives, despite some of the challenges. Hannah Reid is Senior Policy Advisor on Employment Rights at the TUC. I asked her, on that basis, why were they getting involved?
Well, of course, we recognise that for some individuals, they make a positive choice to become self-employed, to run their own business and enjoy the flexibility that that work model offers them. But the TUC is concerned that there's a growing cohort of individuals who are being labelled as self-employed, even though in reality they have very limited choice of what work they do, when they do it. They don't really profit from their work. And in fact, more worryingly, they actually have no safety net in the workplace and are more vulnerable to mistreatment. So I think we need to be clear who it is we're talking about, and as our concern is the growth in self-employment is amongst those individuals who are lower paid and more vulnerable to exploitation.
Yeah, we keep getting told that these marvellous additions to the workforce among the self-employed, a new breed of British entrepreneurs. It doesn't sound like you buy that argument, does it?
The TUC is totally supportive of enterprise. We don't want to see any stifling of enterprise in this country. But increasingly, we're seeing groups of workers, whether it's hairdressers, whether it's couriers, whether it's taxi drivers, whether it's even some people working in food factories, who are being told by their employer, we're no longer directly employing you, we're going to treat you as if you're self-employed. And those individuals have little choice. They want to carry on having a job, they need to earn a living, but they're losing out on basic rights in the workplace, and that is an issue of real concern for us.
Well, that brings us on to the inevitable subject of companies like Uber, and indeed, just this last week, Hermes. And there are cases going through the courts and cases being investigated by HMRC, which are going to test this proposition that somebody can be described as self-employed, but allegedly treated as a directly employed person. What is your expectation of the outcome of this debate?
Well, clearly the Uber case is being supported by the GMB, which is one of the TUC's affiliated unions, and we fully support the GMB in taking that action. It will be a very important test case to look at where the boundaries of self-employment are in this new gig economy. However, the TUC's view is that while, of course, we support the GMB in taking this action, it's not acceptable in a modern society that people only find out if they've got rights in the workplace, if they can afford to go to an employment tribunal, which is a very expensive process these days. Therefore, we in TUC are calling for a root and branch reform of the law. There should be a presumption in our law that says if you are at work, if you are in employment, you should be entitled to the full range of employment rights, including holiday pay and sick pay, which are some of the key issues at stake in the Uber case.
But it just begs that question, what does employment look like? And that's really what the tug of war in the courts is all about.
Absolutely. I mean, I think my understanding is the Uber case is about who actually controls the work. And in many growing industries these days, what we're finding is that people have their tasks allocated to them and indeed their pay rate set by algorithms, by computer programs. And also, they can be subject to discipline. I mean, in relation to Uber, if a driver receives negative client feedback or doesn't take up a particular job offer when they're giving it, they can be deactivated. Now, most of us have heard about being dismissed work. Hopefully we don't ever get dismissed. But now we're talking about language of deactivation of working people. And that obviously is a concern. We need to have a decent framework of rights. We need to make sure that all working people are not subject to exploitation, nor subject to excessive supervision or monitoring in the workplace these days.
It does feel like the concept of work is atomizing before our eyes. And I suppose it's absolutely vital that we do have strong debates in places like courtrooms and indeed with the tax authorities and in government, because this could get out of control. We're already seeing it in around agency workers and some people who are being treated with extraordinary disregard for human, almost human rights, basically. I suppose we really do need to get a handle on this.
Yeah, and there's a real concern for the TUC and indeed for all trade unions and many working people that since the last recession, we have seen a growth in more insecure forms of work, individuals who are losing out on basic protections in the workplace. And often employers are using these new forms of work as well in order, well, they're not new forms of work, but they're using insecure forms of work in order to avoid paying tax as well, which is an area of concern. Now, usually after a financial recession or crisis, we do see an increase in insecure work. But over time, that generally drops. That's not happening currently in the UK. And we are seeing a growth in zero-hours contracts, in agency working, and in self-employment. And our question is within the TUC, is that the right way forward to build a sustainable economy? Because many of the individuals on these contracts, indeed most of them, don't know how much they're going to earn during the course of the week, don't know how many hours of work they're going to be given, and therefore find it very, very difficult to plan, to budget, to pay their household bills. And also many of these individuals in these contracts who are in practice at the beck and call of the employer, they obviously have caring responsibilities, and it's very, very difficult to organise childcare at the last minute.
The people at the fringes, as you mentioned, they are quite vulnerable to those employers who choose not to treat them fairly. What are trade unions actually doing to help these folk? Indeed, can unions help them? I mean, is there any way of unionising?
Well, absolutely. And the recent high-profile cases, we've seen Sports Direct, we're seeing Uber. We know that Unison at the present time are supporting many cases for social care workers who are employed on zero-hours contracts. In many of these workplaces, unions have placed the spotlight on some of the worst, what we would call Victorian-style working practices that we're seeing in the UK. They've brought those practices to public attention, and they're now in those workplaces looking to actually find a solution, find a new way forward that delivers decent pay, decent working conditions for the individuals in these workplaces. So unions have a critical role to play. But we would also say to the government, don't just simply rely on us to come across or to place a spotlight on these odd workplaces. Work with us to actually deliver better working conditions for working people. And one of our key asks to the government is saying, we believe the government should be promoting union presence within workplaces, promoting collective bargaining, because that's the best way of raising standards at work. It's also the best way of delivering fair competition for good employers, because we know there are good employers out there who wouldn't use these practices, but they at the moment are being undercut by the rogue employers who want to deprive people of their basic rights.
Did you derive any optimism from the fact that Theresa May has asked Matthew Taylor, who's the chief executive of the RSA, he's a former policy advisor to Tony Blair and quite a serious thinker on issues surrounding the future of work and things like the basic citizen's income. Now, she's asked him to advise her on workers' rights. Are you encouraged by that?
Well, we welcome the fact that at long last the government has recognised there's a serious problem that needs to be addressed in the UK labour market and in workplaces across the UK. We know that many working people are feeling angry and they feel that they deserve a better deal at work, and sure enough, they do that. So, yes, the Prime Minister's announcement of a new review into insecure work is welcome. It's vital, however, that this review isn't just simply a talking shop, but it delivers real change on the ground, real change to our legal framework, and also real change to ensure that employers aren't avoiding paying their taxes, and also real change to ensure that individuals get genuine protection in the workplace, have a voice in the workplace, and can properly access trade union representation when they're at work.
I don't want to, you know, everybody seems to try to look at things through the lens of Brexit. But of course, we will be approaching a time in 2 years when we will not be members of the European Union. And I suppose that in many ways it behooves us to get our house absolutely in order for that time, because it's going to be, apparently, according to some critics, quite a chill world out there. And we need to get these things settled before that time, because, as I say, it could get very difficult.
Well, the TUC is campaigning for ongoing access to the single market, and we also are campaigning to ensure that all working people's rights are genuinely protected, not only now, not only in the medium term, but in the long term. And yes, we want to have a conversation with the government about how those rights can be secured, can be rooted in the UK, because our real concern is that or our principal objective following the vote on the EU referendum is that working people don't pay the price of the decision of the UK electorate to leave the European Union. Therefore, we need proactive steps by the government to ensure that working people's rights are protected and that we don't become the low-pay, insecure economy on the edges of the European Union.
Hannah, if you don't mind changing gear, changing tack indeed, I just want to talk about something that the TUC has come up with. You commissioned some research that demonstrates that unions can have a positive effect on workplace training. I must confess, this is a new one on me. What role are unions playing in training?
Oh, for many years, trade unions, in fact, for decades, trade unions have played a critical role in working with employers in workplaces to ensure that individuals get better access to training opportunities and can develop their skills, which enable them to become more productive and more contented workforces. And I know the TUC has recently commissioned research reviewing what the impact is of our union learning reps within workplaces. And I think there is clear evidence, not only coming from working people saying this, but also from many employers saying that union-led training programs have a real positive impact on the performance of workplaces, on the profitability of workplaces, on the success of workplaces. And we want to, in the future, again with government support, continue to play a key role in ensuring that we are a high-skill, highly innovative, highly productive economy that can compete in the new global world.
Hannah Reid from the TUC. In a moment, I'll be discussing all this with Microbiz champion Tony Robinson. You're listening to Shop Floor on Share Radio.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
Good morning. This is Nick Peters with you on the shop floor here on Share Radio. We've just heard from the TUC about their desire for more protections for the more vulnerable fringes of the growing cohort of self-employed people in this country. I thought I'd discuss this with Tony Robinson of Enterprise Rockers, the organisation that campaigns on behalf of the self-employed and micro businesses. Now, micros are those companies with 0 to 9 employees, should I say, those businesses, to see how he feels about the trades union movement becoming active in the freewheeling world of self-employment.
Obviously, the trend is for more and more people to become self-employed, and that's the only way. The last 10 years we've known, the next 10 years, as far as we can see, that people are going to be able to earn their own living, whether they want to or not. Large corporations are in meltdown, and of course, many large corporations will take advantage of that fact that most people have to become self-employed, and they will exploit them. And so I think they do need a protection. But I do think, and it's really important, is this, to recognize that all the surveys show that most people that are self-employed would prefer to remain self-employed. And I don't see these corporations actually taking them on as employees on the living wage. So we do need to be aware that they are being exploited, and yep, we've got to do something about that. And the TUC can come up with the right policies for that, and I think that's great. But I think we've got to start from the premise, how do we get people to earn a good living out of being self-employed, which is what they want to do? And this week, the most important and most frightening, and I've mentioned it many, many times, statistics came out that in 1995, the self-employed people, and there were certainly under half of them, well, no, a third of them, were earning £300 a week. Today, they're earning £240 a week. That's £60 less. 80% of self-employed people, measured by the Resolution Foundation, Joseph Rowntree Trust and people, are living in poverty. And the main reason for that is because of debt. And I'd like us to reverse the arguments to actually say, okay, how can we ensure that this increasing number of self-employed people, once they are self-employed, even if they're working for Uber, there's no reason why they can't do something else in self-employment. So, you know, how can we actually ensure that they contribute more to the economy and they earn a decent living?
And what's, I mean, you must have thoughts on that, Tony, but it's not easy because otherwise it wouldn't happen.
No, I agree. And I welcome any organisation, any membership organisation. I certainly welcome the TUC getting involved in this space. I think it's very important. I think the zero hours things and the self-employment that are not self-employed is just a ways of ensuring that they don't get sickness pay and various things is it's a real problem. So let's sort it out. Let's stop the exploitation. But I am saying that even the people that are being exploited, 80% of them would prefer the continuing independence, and they'd prefer to be able to find a way of remaining self-employed and earning a decent living. And that should be our starting point.
I think it's great, as you said, you know, obviously that the TUC is getting behind workers who they don't represent them necessarily because they're not unionised. But having said that, it strikes me that it's a pretty rich area out there. We've got all these people coming into self-employment and a lot of them on the fringes. If I was running a union, I'd be out there trying to sign them up or start a new one.
I'm right with you on that. I think it's really, really important that there is representation. It's been recommended a number of times. I've recommended it as well, that there is a union. You know, I've tried with various communities over the years and various things, and I believe it is important that there is a union. It's very different from what we traditionally think of as a union, but it will actually protect and promote self-employed and business owners from exploitation. Now, I mean, for example, you know, my recurring theme is always about paying 30 days. But at the end of the day, more businesses are in debt. Yeah, more people are losing their houses. More people are unable to get a mortgage. More people are in dire financial straits, because large corporations take their goods on 75-day terms and they've had to pay out to make the goods or do the services immediately. Yeah? And that's why I say any corporation that government contract with, it can really show the lead. That £96 billion of money can be floating around the UK and it could be paying people in 30 days. Now, those are exactly the kind of things that a trade union could actually represent a government.
They should take a leaf out of your book, Tony, Enterprise Rockers.
Absolutely, I agree. I'll tell them the model. Who is it? Francis O'Grady, is it? I forget.
Who's the? It is. Yeah, you're right.
Is that Francis O'Grady, yeah. So, well, I hope she's listening.
Let's move on to the IOD, because we heard in the programme from Stephen Herring that they recommended, they wrote to the Times, they were part of a large group of entrepreneurs and business people who wrote to the Times saying, you know what, the government needs to do something about the 20,000 pages of tax laws we got in this country, needs to be simplified. But as far as the self-employed and small businesses are concerned, what he was saying was that the goal has to be to remove large chunks of the smaller businesses in this country out of corporation tax if they're incorporated, obviously, and emulate the American system where you have an S corporation where there's only one tax to be paid, and everything is much simpler. In other words, a small business in this country shouldn't be viewed by the tax man through the same lens as they look at a GlaxoSmithKline, for instance. That's got to make a lot of sense, does it not?
Yes, it does. I mean, I think that it's one of the things we're kind of worried about Matthew Taylor, chief executive of the RSA, doing this new look at businesses and self-employment, if you like. And if you look at the brief that the government are giving them, it sounds like, you know, they're looking at issues like job security, progression, growth, all of those kind of things, when in actual fact, we should actually say, well, enterprise is enterprise, as Michael Gerber did with the E-Myth, and it's about getting people able to make money out of their enterprise. And the first thing that will help them is to simplify the whole rigmarole that we've got of taxation and stealth taxation as well, Nick. I mean, one of the things I fear, and auto enrollment started this off really, is that government will continue to look through the same lens they're looking at large employers to small business owners, and they'll try and collect more and more things towards healthcare, towards maternity leave, towards paternity leave, towards, you know, all of these different things. And I would suggest it's for business owners with less than 50 employees, if you like, which is 97.8% and 93% are below 10 employees. So it's something in that region. And I think that's important. And I would do it on employees as well, because for years, the big corporations who have been in meltdown regarding jobs, reducing their employees in millions, have always said, well, corporation tax doesn't really count because we actually pay loads of money through payroll taxes. Well, actually, they reduce lots and lots of staff and still don't pay corporation tax. So I think it should be on 0 to 9 employees or 0 to 50 employees, if you like, that this specific business tax that leaves the business owner to get on with their business and not worry about all these different things is tremendously important. And I think that's a really good suggestion from the IOD.
Yeah, you and I have talked before about the danger that what the government actually wants to do is try and somehow wrap its arms around the self-employed in this country, because they're terrified they're going to be losing tax revenues. So they want to keep their eyes on them. And that's why they might get all these reporting things. We've got this quarterly reporting thing coming up next year, I believe. That is a suspicion. A government and the tax man is always going to want to keep their eyes on you.
Yes, I think so. I think the 4 times a year digital taxation, there's all sorts of stealth taxes can come in there, can't let it hit us. So, yeah, let's go with the idea, IOD, and let's have a different lens looking at business owners, because of what we want is a thriving enterprise economy. Yeah, we want people actually earning and being able to pay more tax because they're earning more. And if we look at it through that lens, then I think it works for us.
Tony, we've only got a few seconds left, but I want to talk to you about Microbiz Matters Day, because that's coming up in January and it's not very long to go. Tell us what's going to happen.
Yeah, January the 13th, Friday, as usual, kicks off the year all the way around the world, Microbiz Matters Day, and that means business owners all the way around the world will be giving at least 13 minutes to help other business owners. So it's business owners helping business owners. We're actually broadcasting from Pimlico Plumbers. There are some city parties in different countries. Alicia Silberg, the entrepreneur, is hosting one in New York. And the whole city of Hull, which is City of Culture, and you know that's a special place for me, is having a massive party, council approved, everybody's got involved, on Microbiz Matters Day. And so lots of people will actually get together to help each other and actually just celebrate Microbiz Matters. And there'll be 8 hours of learning from Pimlico Plumbers, where we Tina and I, as you know, interview lots of interesting people and get their tips and ideas to help in different sectors like food and drink, e-marketing, or whatever it happens to be. So it's a fantastic opportunity worldwide. And we've got two premier partners, which are ScanSnap, which is part of Fujitsu, because obviously they sell a lot of scanners to micro businesses. Charlie Mullins, of course, as you know very well, with Pimlico Plumbers. It'll be a fantastic day, and everybody will be able to see Google Hangouts and on YouTube as well. And hopefully you'll be able to capture the atmosphere as well, Nick.
We shall be there. We shall be there, Tony, as always. Bless your heart. Thank you for joining us today, this Sunday, and I really appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks, Nick.
The legend that is Tony Robinson. And if you want to learn more about Microbiz Matters Day, which I can tell you is an absolutely great occasion, it's well worth getting involved, go to the following website. Now, it has an unusual URL, www.microbizmattersday.rocks, R-O-C-K-S, microbizmattersday.rocks. You're on the shop floor. In a moment, former Lib Dem government minister Joe Swinson and why companies are bungling their talent policies.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
And you're on the shop floor this lovely Sunday with me, Nick Peters. Now, before the Conservatives won an outright majority in 2015, the Lib Dem MP Joe Swinson was Equalities Minister in the coalition government. She lost her seat in the election, but has retained her interest in the subject of equality by setting up a consultancy called Equal Power. She's also been saying some interesting things recently about how automation, you know, robotics and the like, might affect the way we look at people whose work currently doesn't earn them quite the respect they deserve.
I think it's really interesting when we look at the advance of technology and the type of roles that technology is going to automate out of existence. So anything that requires lots of calculations or attention to detail in audit type roles, a lot of these jobs are going to be some of the first to go to automation and be overtaken by robots. Content production, you even got robots that can now, you know, write articles. So journalists and some
Don't say that. You put me out of a job.
I don't think it's quite there with the comment and opinion pieces that provide a really nuanced view of the world. But some of the really basic putting facts and figures into stories, you know, there are already programs that can do that. So there's a lot of the knowledge type jobs and actually some quite high skilled jobs that will go. But I think it's interesting when you look at what's going to be most difficult for robots to replicate. And it's things like creativity and, you know, innovation, bringing together, you know, entirely different concepts and ideas, and also the interaction with human beings. So, you know, the holy grail of artificial intelligence, trying to be able to have an intelligent conversation with a human being. And there's progress on that. But when it comes to actually reading body language, understanding how someone else is feeling, and being able to then respond in an emotionally intelligent way, that's really where robots are light years behind. And it's going to be hardest for them to catch up. And so I'm not saying this is my prediction, but I think it's interesting to consider whether some of the roles that we currently have seen as in some way low skill or low value, which I think is not an accurate way of describing them in the caring professions, actually become the type of job that is something which is much more revered and recognised for the value it brings. Because after all, if you're trying to, you know, implant ideas in the next generation when you're doing childcare, or you're dealing with perhaps somebody at the end of their life caring for somebody who's terminally ill, actually the emotional energy and intelligence combined with professional understanding that's needed for those jobs is actually very skilled. Perhaps we'll start to see it more that way when robots take on other roles.
I think that's a rather lovely irony, actually, and I do hope you're right about that, because it does hold out something rather charming, which is that people who have those skills and who currently, as you say, we don't perhaps rank highly enough because we pay more credit to people who manage money and other stuff like that. But these are the people who actually will matter most to us in the future.
Well, indeed. And I think there is an irony here, because you know, if you speak to somebody who's just witnessed an elderly relative go through the last weeks of their life in a hospice, and you ask them about the staff that cared for them, I mean, you'll get nothing but the highest respect. And yet many of these roles are some of the lowest paid in society. So I think there is a disconnect there in how we're currently valuing these roles. I think there's an element of that which is gendered, because historically we have not valued the roles that women have performed, and in particular what has in the past often been the unpaid work that women have done. And as those roles then became more in the labour market itself, they still kept that sort of status of not being valued because they were associated with women doing them. And, you know, I think that's just one of the ways in which, you know, gender equality has a real impact on our whole economy.
Yeah, it's going to be a murky future, isn't it? Because, I mean, the pessimists say that whenever a tech revolution comes along, and particularly this one, the robots are going to chuck most of us on the scrap heap. The optimists say, well, every tech revolution creates new kinds of jobs. But the fact is that someone always does lose out. And oddly enough, wages towards the lower end of the spectrum tend to stagnate or fall, whatever happens, don't they?
I think the benefits of technological advance will not necessarily be evenly shared. And I think that's a real problem, particularly in a society where there is already a lot of discomfort about the gulf between the very well-paid elite who have access to wealth and very high income, and people struggling to get by, working two jobs on the minimum wage. And we saw that, you know, in the Brexit vote here in the UK, but you can see that same railing against the way things are in other countries, and often in quite damaging and dangerous populist movements, which I think would lead our society in quite a difficult direction. So I think there is a real issue there about how the benefits of technology, how do we get it to really benefit everyone, not just in that way in which we, you know, we appreciate having the internet and it's convenient, but in the type of work that we do as well, rather than the people that happen to have all of the money to invest in the new technology just reaping all the benefits, and then who cares what happens to the labour force.
You suggest that if we're not careful, we could carry over the sort of stereotypes and perpetuate the gender bias against women that does operate in the workplace. And there's no doubting that currently, and has done, of course, for decades. Hopefully it's improving. But how can we avoid that? I mean, what do we need to do as we enter the threshold, cross the threshold of this new revolution? What do we need to do to avoid this?
I think the first thing we need to do is to get rid of the complacency, which I think exists. You know, we've got a woman prime minister here in the UK. Please let's hope we're about to have a woman president of the United States. And there will be choruses of voices saying that the battle for gender equality is over. As we heard, you know, Kevin Roberts of Saatchi, you know, suggest just a few months ago, there will be people who think that that means that there is no longer an inequality, and that nothing else needs to happen, or even that, you know, we've got more girls doing well at school, more graduates who are young women coming out of our universities, and the problem will all just sort of right itself in time. But I think there's a real danger in that complacency, because actually that's been the case in our universities in many courses for, you know, 15, 20 years. And we're not seeing the inequality broken down in the senior levels of different industries. It is entrenched, and it is only changed when there's a concerted effort. So things like the gender pay gap reporting, which was the last thing I managed to achieve in government and is coming in from next year. Things like the initiatives for women on boards, which focused first on non-executives, and now the executive pipeline is the focus. You know, these initiatives and drives are more important than ever, but also having the leadership and the culture from the top to just recognise this is an issue, to recognise that the workplace is not some kind of ungendered space. Actually, it has been designed for men by men, and we shouldn't be beating people up about that. We should just all be recognising that it's in everyone's interest to have a more equal society, and get on with creating that.
Teaching and skills are just becoming ever more important. And I'm wondering if you think that the current system of education and training in this country is really up to the task.
So there's fantastic work done in our school system and in, you know, higher and further education. I think there's definitely changes that need to be made. I think that we're very rigid in our view of what a good education is, and so we for some reason, sort of prize an academic degree above all else. And I don't think that is sensible in this day and age. There's many different routes to further training, and they ought to be valued more evenly. But I think there's also sometimes a bit of a rush to say, oh, we need to be teaching all children how to code. And there's undoubtedly a need for different skills in our economy, whether that's more science and engineering and technology. But I think it's broader than that. I think actually the skills that are needed is going to be resilience and adaptability. I mean, basically, we're going to have a rapidly changing society. And so the jobs that our young people will be coming out of school and doing in 10 years don't exist yet. And the ones that they'll be doing in 25 years, you know, we probably haven't even thought of yet. So it's not about saying what are the skills we need for today's labour market. It's about how can we equip young people with the attitude, the resilience and the ability to continue learning that means that they will be able to be productive, valued members of the labour market and contributing to the economy throughout their lives.
Yes, that's actually a very pertinent point, because it is about that agility. People use that word in human resources, HR and all that. And they talk about agile companies. Well, we need agile people to work in those companies.
Absolutely. You know, we've long been saying that the days of working for 40 years for one company are long gone. But I mean, if you think about the number of jobs that young people have in such a short space of time now, and actually even the concept of a job with the gig economy and the insecurity of work. I mean, there's opportunities and threats within that, but there is definitely a move, very often facilitated by technology, to a much more fluid structure of work. But it also does bring real challenges for how do you make sure that employment protections that are there for very good reason are not undermined. And I think the review that Matthew Taylor is going to be undertaking for government is a really important one that will be interesting. And it's one of the issues that in my final year in government, Vince Cable and I were looking at through the employment status and what needs to change. And so there's a body of work there which is available for that Taylor review to be able to build on.
Since leaving government and the House of Commons, you've made gender equality at work your main purpose in life. Tell us what you're doing with Equal Power Consulting.
So Equal Power Consulting helps organisations to work out how they need to change to enable all of their workforce to thrive. There's often a lot of focus around sort of fixing the woman with training and mentoring and networks, all of which can be useful, but they really rest on the premise that there's something wrong with the woman in the workplace rather than something often wrong in the workplace itself. And I think that's the starting point, really, for where we do need to focus most of the changes that we need. And I'm writing a book which is much wider than that, not just about the workplace, but about how all of these issues across society are connected. So, you know, violence against women is an endemic problem in the UK, but actually in societies across the world. And, you know, you often don't think of that in the context, say, of the workplace, but, you know, there'll be a significant proportion of your employees that are experiencing or at some point will experience domestic violence, or they might be the victim of a sexual assault. Indeed, sexual harassment is a significant issue in the workplace, we found from the Project 28 to 40 report. So, you know, these issues are actually, they're not sort of siloed. They're not in different boxes. When I spoke to senior businesswomen, very often the conversation would turn when we said, what do we need to do differently, to the pressures on young girls and how they look and how the focus is on women's appearance rather than on their abilities. So I'm really trying to get across the point that gender inequality in society is a big and complex issue, and it's interconnected. And obviously the workplace is one part of that, and employers have a responsibility, as we all do, in doing their bit to solve their part of the problem.
Jo Swinson of Equal Power Consulting, and you can learn more from www.equalpower, all one word, equalpower.co.uk. You're listening to Shop Floor on Share Radio. In a moment, why companies are apparently failing to manage their talent properly.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
It's 16 minutes to 11. You're listening to Shop Floor on Share Radio with me, Nick Peters. Now, it's one of those perennial issues around HR. Why do all the great ideas and visions around the proper management of people so often fail to get put into practice by businesses? why are they pretty much sidelined? The HR consultancy Orion Partners did some research and found that very few companies had what it calls integrated talent management, or should I say an integrated talent management process. It's a bit of a clunky phrase. I asked Jane Chesters, co-founder of Orion, what it means.
For me, it's not rocket science. It's about, as an organisation, being really clear what kind of people with what kind of skills and capabilities you believe you're going to need, where and when, and determining whether or not those are skills and capabilities you're going to build or buy, and then having a really clear view of how you're going to get them, how are you going to develop them? How are you going to manage and reward them so that you retain what's needed? So it sounds simple. I think the trick is that point that you made in the question around integration and how joined up that process is. So it's the fact that it all links together rather than being pockets of activity focused on trying to do the same thing.
But it sounds, dare I say it, most organisations, doesn't everybody do this? I mean, it sounds common sense to me.
It is common sense. As I said, it's not rocket science. Most HR folk, when you ask them what's their kind of raison d'etre, it's about ensuring the organisation has the right people in the right place with the right skills at the right time. That being said, simplicity is not always that easy to achieve. And I think what you find is pockets of great practice in parts of that process. So some organizations will be really clear about what they need to get and how they'll get it. But does that then join up with how they develop people? Does that then join up with the way in which they think about rewarding people? How does that join up with the way in which they think about managing people's performance? That's the more difficult trick to pull off, I think. No, and I think there's another point as well, in that in truly successful organisations, none of this is an HR process. This is a business process. This is what businesses are doing in terms of managing their people, and HR is providing the right tools and support to do that. But I think there are still a number of organisations where managing talent is seen as something that HR needs to do rather than being a business process that HR is there to provide, you know, the right expertise on to do effectively.
Well, now you've explained that, I think it's easy to understand that, you know, all these things can look good on paper, but they got to be put into effective practice.
Yeah.
And what you're saying with your research is that something only like a quarter of the HR directors you spoke to managed to achieve that, or should I say more properly, the companies for which they work managed to have an integrated talent process.
Yes, this particular insight came from a recent piece we did where we were actually asking organisations about the concept of agility and how important it was to be organisationally agile and what HR's role in that was. And so we talked about 30 different organisations, large, small, complex organisations, all saying, yes, we are facing unprecedented levels of change from a number of areas, changing requirements from a customer perspective, and that's both internal and external, market competition, and also, as I think everyone is very much aware these days, the kind of hugely disruptive nature of technology. We asked them to think about what are the sort of things that are critical to you from an agility perspective. At the top of that, as you might expect, was the ability to spot and respond to new opportunities. But almost as important were things like having the right leaders, having visibility of the right talent and the flexibility of that talent, having the ability in the organization to ensure that people collaborate effectively. And what we found when we asked people, how important is that to you? Those kind of elements came out as being really critical. But the number of HR directors who felt their businesses were able to say, we are highly effective at managing talent, ensuring we have the visibility and flexibility, was zero. So they all recognised they were working towards achieving those objectives, but none of them could put their hands on their hearts and say, we know we are highly effective at that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really quite amazing. Whose fault is this? I mean, is this down to boards who don't listen properly to what their HR directors are saying, or is it HR directors who are not selling the story properly to the board?
I think it's a combination. I mean, I think we spend a significant amount of our time helping HR functions be more effective. And I think it is fair to say that some of the efforts, well, a large number of the efforts that have been focused on improving the effectiveness of HR over the last 10, 15 years have been on getting the operations right, ensuring the basics work seamlessly. And that's not to say that that's not really important, because if that, you know, if that's not the case, then the more strategic considerations don't get a look in. So I think the focus has been historically about efficiency, about getting the operations to perform at the right level, with less emphasis on the more specialist areas of talent. But I think also that piece I talked about earlier, which is this isn't HR's fault, in inverted commas, this is a business issue where the real ownership of what is it we're trying to achieve as a business and what role do people play in that is not as high on some organizations' agenda or on some leaders' agenda as it needs to be.
It has to be said that this is very short-term thinking, because quite apart from all the other disruptive issues there are in our lives at the moment, the competition for talent is only getting tougher. I mean, there's not enough talent being produced in this country. And yes, if we look at the more pessimistic side of the Brexit debate, it may be that not enough talent is going to be allowed into the country. And this is only going to get worse.
I think organisations who, and it's interesting, you know, you say when you talk about the shadow of Brexit, and if you just think about potentially what the economic impact may be, historically, when times get tough, people are even more short-termist in their views and get back to the stuff that we all know how to do, which is cut costs, improve efficiency. And the ability then for organisations to transform, regenerate, be agile is even less. So yeah, I would share your concern. I mean, I've been working in and around this space for 25 years. I see some organizations achieving amazing things. That's not to say that it's all doom and gloom, but it is somewhat depressing that harnessing the capabilities of people, understanding how best to deploy them, is not something we're better at than we could and should be.
You use a rather interesting Olympic Games metaphor to describe the way that this is approached in British business.
Yes, I mean, I think it's topical because we are all in awe of what's been achieved. For us to be number two in the medals table, as just, you know, it's at a time, I think, in the UK when we were all feeling a bit shell-shocked and unsettled by what it meant to be British, and maybe a personal perspective, but it's been an amazing achievement. And I think what we were trying to say is, you know, the right attitude about making sure we had absolutely the right people and worked on all of the various components that need to be brought together to ensure that a team performs, which is, you know, I suppose a metaphor for an organization. If we'd focused on just on the backroom stuff, on how efficient or cost effective we might be in supporting that kind of effort, we wouldn't have had the results that we did. So yeah, undoubtedly I'm aiming to be topical because we are very proud of what's been achieved at the moment. But I think you can see the parallels between investing in the right place and focusing on the right things.
Yeah, and having some kind of vision, because that's, yes, the Olympics was all about. We had a vision for what kind of sporting achievements we wanted and then set about achieving it. And
it's clarity of purpose. Why are we here? And everything flows from that. And if you spend your time just focusing on what are we doing without that clarity of purpose, you get very different results.
I feel sort of quite sympathetic to HR because it's sometimes, well, quite often, I suppose, is still seen as something of a soft add-on to business. So, the people who are doing the making and the selling see themselves as the most important, and HR just does fluffy stuff behind the scenes, easy to dismiss, easy to economize on. I'm obviously, this is wrong at every level. As I say, this seems to be how an awful lot of companies behave.
I agree with you that I feel, somewhat sorry for HR. I think there has been a tendency sometimes for the function to be a bit apologetic and a bit insecure. But I think organisations also sometimes get the HR functions they deserve. Leaders who are clear about what it is they're trying to achieve and how the people in that organisation will help them deliver on that are the ones that succeed. And I know sometimes when we talk with organisations, when we talk about the effectiveness of their HR function, and some of the senior people we talk to say, well, why do I need to bother? Why do you need to talk to me about HR? It's obvious, I just need people paid on time and I need accurate information. But if you start to open up the conversation and say, okay, what are the business challenges you face? You very quickly start to unpick the fact that actually the majority of them, irrespective of sector, be it construction or financial services or retail, it's about people. They then start to actually be able to articulate quite clearly what is the role of people management and HR as the profession that supports that. But I think HR is a function that is perhaps somewhat more self-flagellating than others. I don't know that finance people or marketing people ask themselves quite so many questions about how effective they are.
Existentialism rules.
Existentialism rules, yeah.
Jane, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure. Nice to speak to you.
Jane Chesters of Orion Partners, bringing us to the end of Shop Floor. Many thanks for being with us. In a moment, Linda Lewis will be here with Company Casebook with a report on legal cost finance and a special report on the Small Business Awards. I'll be back at 9 o'clock next Sunday. So from me, Nick Peters, goodbye for now.